Welcome to the Embodying Aware Parenting Podcast.
Exploring what parenting feels like from the inside out with Sarah Devoy and Vicky Plomer.
I'm really pleased to be joined today with my co-host Sarah, and we have the wonderful Joss Golden here today, who has taken the time out to join us on our podcast. So welcome, Sarah and Joss. Really lovely to have you here. We're going to start with just inviting Joss to share what drew you to aware parenting. How did that begin, that journey for you?
Well, the short-ish version is that I was very interested in attachment and trauma, and I studied psychology at university, and as part of that process, learned a lot about what children need to thrive, what happens when that doesn't quite work out that way, and how to support children in the most nurturing and loving way, and read a lot about all kinds of different things, including the continuum concept by Jean Liedloff, which is based on her time in Venezuela with the Yaquana people, or Ecuador, I'm sorry, can't remember which. Venezuela, I think it is, where she writes really beautifully about what children really need in order to thrive and how we have always evolved to live in communities and how children are supported in those communities to have close attachments, to feel safe, to feel connected and to be supported. And it really spoke to me. And I thought, if I ever have children, I really want to read this book again. And so I did lots of further studies. I did counseling, and I also had lots of therapy myself. And then I became a parent, and I reread the continuum concept again. And I was really clear and committed that I wanted to try to focus and prioritize attachment and connection with my new baby. So we did all the things, the co-sleeping, the long-term breastfeeding, the slings, the, you know, all of those sorts of things, being responsive to him. And it was beautiful and lovely, but he didn't sleep very much and he woke up frequently. And I had this belief that I really wanted to stop him crying anytime he cried. I really prided myself on the fact that anytime he cried, I could stop him really quickly by singing and jiggling and breastfeeding and rocking and all of those things. And so he didn't sleep very well, and it was fine, but I quite quickly became very exhausted. But I just presumed that's what motherhood was, and if you wanted to do it this way, then that's what it meant for you. Everyone around me was saying, you must do controlled crying. It's the only way to get children to sleep. But I was really not willing to do that. So I just suffered and didn't get very much sleep. And then I became pregnant again, and my daughter was born, and I was just like so concerned about her sleep. My son had a really complex and difficult birth. My daughter had a really beautiful birth, but she didn't sleep very well either. And that coincided with my son going into the toddler years and becoming very vocal, having tantrums. And I just couldn't understand where my beautiful baby had gone and why this child was so wild and furious in front of me. And so quickly, I tried all kinds of different things to support sleep in always connected and loving ways, but nothing worked. And then a friend of mine discovered aware parenting, read an article by Marion, and immediately it just made sense to me. So I had some sessions with her. And what I really loved about it was this knowing that children can release and heal through crying with loving support and return back to a balanced, connected, relaxed, beautiful state, and that all we have to do is learn how to listen in order to support them that way. And it really made sense to me from my own experiences too, of how good you feel after a big cry. And so it felt like that was the missing piece really in the whole picture. We were already doing the other aspects of aware parenting, but the third part around listening to feelings and play was a really new thing for me. But straight away, I could see a difference in my daughter's sleeping. Straight away, I could see a difference in regaining the loving connection and the closeness with my beautiful boy and supporting him to go through huge feelings, which of course he had as a result of not having been listened to for the first 2 years of his life. and all the frustrations of all the times that he tried to share with me how he was feeling, and I'd shushed him out of it. So there were lots of big feelings to listen to. And then slowly I realized, reluctantly at first, that actually it was quite a lot about me and having my feelings heard and getting support for myself. So it became this really beautiful parallel journey, and I really loved the aspect of aware parenting around meeting needs and that everybody's needs in the family matter, although it took me a long time to prioritize my needs. And, you know, initially I was very much thinking that my needs mattered, but my children's needs mattered more. So that was a bit of a journey too. But I really loved how clearly it understood children and how to support children to return to balance and to feel calm and loving and connected again.
Yeah, I love that journey, and I love how there was that aspect that you already had parts of the aware parenting really kind of in your home and solid, but you could see that one valuable part was missing. And that's so beautiful how you were able to journey and notice what that actually really meant when you put it into practice and the immediate effects it sounds like it had on your family with the sleeping. And then the journeying on to noticing needs, right? It's such a massive part, isn't it? When we can figure out that, we actually have needs that we might need to meet. And yeah, and how that is in practice again can be such a massive thing to overcome. We have got another question I wanted to move on to, but I'm wondering actually, Sarah, did you want to come in with your expertise around kind of birth and looking at that, and I just wanted to invite you if you have any questions at this point. Or you're just on mute.
Thanks so much for bringing me in. It's lovely to hear the story, and I'm smiling here, of course, like I'm sure many other parents will be, about that whole process. And I love the way, I like what I'm getting really excited about in the conversation, how you're bringing yourself into it, yourself as a person and a parent. And, you know, I'd love to hear a little bit more about that in a way. I mean, yes, I could talk a little bit about the birth thing, but it's in a way like how we were born, I guess, and how we came into the world and the kind of environment that we, perhaps the soup that we grew up in. You may or may not want to explore that today, but I find that makes it really come alive for me when I reflect on where I came from and why certain things may be a trigger for me. I don't know whether you want to speak to that in an embodied sense.
Yeah, well, I think part of the reason why I was so interested in humans and relationship and attachment and connection and supporting children to thrive was because my own experience had been very, very different. And of course, I mean, I grew up in the 70s where there really wasn't much known about attachment or about trauma. You know, unless you were a specialist in that field, it wasn't part of common language. And I was born at a time when in the hospital they would bring the food around for the mothers and they would bring the bottles around for the babies at the same time. And that's when babies were fed, and that's how babies were fed. And so that was my early story. My parents certainly knew nothing about listening to feelings. They didn't really know either about the importance for closeness and connection and sleeping together or any of that kind of stuff. That wasn't my experience. And then when I was 8 years old, I went to boarding school, and so experienced a lot of really challenging and difficult and scary things, but also a real broken attachment from what was already a very different attachment to what I offered my children. And being in that school environment was, it was a really hard thing for an 8-year-old child to go through. And it was very interesting when my children, particularly when my daughter became 8, it was just such a confronting and powerful healing opportunity for me to see how much she still needed me and closeness and all the lovely things that we provide in aware parenting. So I, you know, thinking of it from an embodied sense, I realized, you know, the more I've gone on to learn about trauma and how trauma affects us and what our bodies do when trauma isn't released and healed, the more I've seen that my childhood was predominantly spent either in a state of hyperarousal in the moments when I was really frightened, which were many, or in a dissociative state when it all became too much to bear. And of course, we weren't allowed to cry. We didn't have support. There was no pastoral care at the school at all in those days. And so, yeah, I spent a lot of my childhood in one or either of those states. And so it wasn't really, in spite of having lots of therapy to address that in my early 20s, it wasn't really till I discovered aware parenting and started to understand in more depth these things around what is going on at a neurobiological level with trauma and how healing works that I was really able to, first of all, recognize that that had been the patterns of my life that I was still in and what I could do about it and how I could start to really heal and transform at a really deep body level by incorporating the beautiful practices of aware parenting and offering them to myself.
Oh, that's just so touching. I'm just really feeling it in my chest, actually, as you're saying those things of just being 8 years old. That is such a tender kind of experience. I don't know. It's I'm sure a lot of people are very touched by listening to that. Would you like to say something, Vicky, around that, or how are you doing?
Yeah, I absolutely. I think when we get a chance to reflect on what our journey into the world was and where we were met and like the culture around when we were born into that time and what was accepted, what wasn't accepted, and then we can bring that to now and the joy that we can change with in our own families and the lineage that we can stop and that we can shift it and make it something else. I think it's just phenomenal that can happen at any point, you know, like you came to aware parenting when you said, you know, there were two, so it was 2 years for your son, you know, others maybe later. And I think it's just a joy with aware parenting that it doesn't matter what age you come and what your journey was into life and how you were raised, that actually you can change all of that and you can allow the healing and that trauma can be healed at any point. And as you said, with the moving into hyperarousal or dissociation and then having the therapy, but then when your children come to that age and when you think you've done it all and you think you've, well, oh, that's all ticked off the box, another onion layer comes, right? And then you're able to revisit and reheal in a different place and notice what's happening for you in that journey. So yeah, I think that was just beautiful. Thanks for asking that question, Sarah. I wondered if you might describe for us what, as our podcast is called Embodying Aware Parenting, which is quite a, you know, interesting word to use. So there's no right or wrong with this, but would love to know what your view of embodying aware parenting is in your life.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and it's something that I feel really deeply, and I'm really aware of what the sensations are in my body when I'm really in an embodied state with aware parenting, but it's quite hard to find the words to describe what that is. But I think it's essentially being and staying deeply connected with myself as much as possible. And initially, I think for me, it was really, I was so passionate about aware parenting. I was really like living it and breathing it and reflecting on everything. And I was talking all the time and thinking about it and learning and exploring and experimenting and having so many conversations about it. And I found that that really created in me this real embodied understanding of the theory. But then it comes to the practice, doesn't it? Which is a whole different story, really. And I think the more I learned to tend to myself and to take care of my needs and to receive listening and acknowledgement for my feelings, the more I was able to really be at home in my body, whatever my body was feeling, and for the first time in my life to start to feel safe to actually be present in the moment with whatever arises and to be able to be vulnerable and to be able to share with others and to be able to be uncomfortable and to know that you're safe in those moments and to tune into what sensations you are experiencing when you go into hyperarousal, for example, or knowing when I'm in a dissociation state, what it is that I can recognize in my body that is telling me that and showing me that and how I can bring love and warmth and care to that to bring me back out again. And it's also, for me, a big part of it has been around not being judgmental around feelings, my own feelings or anybody else's feelings, and instead learning to change that inner dialogue from one that was really harsh and critical and judgmental, both of myself and others, to one that is much more accepting and unconditional in how I feel about myself. And I think when we notice what it feels like in our bodies to have that experience of being heard and releasing, and to be able to see the contrast between those moments of feelings where you're tight and you're contracted and it's painful and it's, there's lots of tension. And for me, I particularly feel it in my throat. I feel my throat close up and go dry, or I feel it in my belly. I feel this sort of, nervous rumbling and kind of nauseous sort of movement in my belly. And when I am contrasting that with what it feels like after I've actually dived into some feelings and sunk into what's there, where it just feels open and relaxed and spacious and soft and warm and balanced and all of those things, that's when I really started to realize what it meant to really embody aware parenting for myself. And of course, then from that place, I got so much better at being able to support my children in this way. And again, to be able to notice when their behavior and their bodies were showing me that they were in these states, and how I could learn to trust that they are always wanting to come back to balance. They are always wanting to release and heal. And when we are just noticing what their behavior might be telling us about what's going on for them, and then supporting them in these beautiful ways by showing up and holding space for them, we again can see this real beautiful, calm, relaxed, loose, connected softness in them. So, yeah, it is a parallel process. And, you know, often with our children, in order to feel this sense of embodiment with it, I've really needed to feel grounded and clear and sort of solid. Like sometimes I visualize myself like as a tree or as a rock or as some kind of lifeguard supporting my child through the storms of what's going on for them. And that takes some time and some practice to be able to get yourself into that state and to stay in that state when there's lots of big feelings going around you. But yeah, there's a lot of power in tuning in, reminding yourself around what's going on, reminding yourself that your children they've got big feelings, and it's not that they're being deliberately difficult or mean or, you know, winding you up or any of those things. And it's not that you're having to do anything, really. It's that you are just there to hold that space and to feel truly present with them, which, yeah, it really requires us to be able to be really present with ourselves. So those are some of the things that I think of when I think of embodied aware parenting. I mean, I think the other thing that's really helpful is to be able to tune in and recognize when our children's behavior is triggering stuff or activating stuff in us that is part of our story. And that requires, again, this capacity to be willing to dive into what's painful and to sit in that discomfort and to explore what's there for us, so that increasingly we can tend to ourselves in those moments when we are being triggered and activated. We can recognize what's going on. We can reassure ourselves that we'll come back to that and explore that later. And then we come back to being able to offer that presence to our children in the moment. But that's quite hard. And often, you know, it requires lots of reflection and lots of time thinking and sharing with others and talking to listening partners and so on, to get really clear about the bits that are there for us in the story that our children are telling us and the bits that are there for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is such a key part, right, isn't it? To be able to, like you say, be fully grounded. I love that vision of being the lifeguard in the storm. I really enjoyed when you were saying that. I felt really like I could embody that vision of being that lifeguard while there's this storm, especially of my 13-year-old, that can be quite a big storm at times. You're like this solid tree, stone. Yeah, I really love that. And absolutely that part of understanding what is for you in this and what is theirs and separating those two, it can be, like you say, a journey to expressing how you're feeling, like over and over with listening partners, right? And having that support to do that. And I enjoyed how you described how you were in a hyperarousal state where you could feel your jaw. Is that, would you say that was your hyperarousal, where you go into a jaw clenching, it closes up, or is that your freeze state, or do you think it mixes for you in both, how you feel the sensations in your body?
It, for me, it's very much when I'm in that hyperarousal strain. It's not so much in my jaw, it's more in my throat. And it's not that there's a frozenness to it. It's like a terror kind of response.
Yeah.
There's a real fear and unsettledness in it. And it's, you know, it's not the same as the mild dissociation or comfort. It's a very uncomfortable place in my body. So, yeah, it's much more for me that hyperarousal. Dissociation for me is more like just zoned out and switched off and not really there. I don't get that same intensity of feeling that I really associate with, you know, fear, terror, that kind of thing, powerlessness.
And have you gone through a process where you felt quite numb to your emotions before you were able to recognize? I know we have quite a few listeners that maybe can't identify with the feeling or sensations in the body. And I'm wondering if there was a period for you where you felt quite numb to those feelings. And if there was, how did you journey to now identifying and naming, now this is that powerlessness in, I'm holding my throat. I realize you can't see me, but that the throat closing, that deep fear that you hold in there.
Yeah, I mean, I was completely disconnected from my body, and I had no understanding about feelings. In spite of studying psychology and doing counselling, I really still had no understanding, really, about feelings and about how feelings show up in your body and about that sort of somatic aspect to it. I was completely disconnected from my body. And in fact, at school, we had to be. So I really learned at a young age to completely switch off from any feelings that I might be having. So I wasn't aware of any of that. And I think it's just been a gradual process, really, of learning. And I remember quite early on learning, and I think we'll talk about this more in one of the other questions, but learning about how to scan through my body and identify sensations that are there. And, yeah, I've done lots of courses and read lots, as well as receiving support and listening from people who understand this approach and understand this way, in order to help me increasingly to be able to identify for myself with less and less need for that external guidance and hand holding on that process. But it's a gradual process. I mean, I've been practicing aware parenting for 18 years, and it's taken a long time to get to this place. And I still often miss it. I often have to, you know, I often have really big feelings and I'm not really aware of what's going on. And then I think, hang on a minute, okay, come back to the body. What's going on? You know, so, yeah, it's a process.
I think that's really lovely to hear, and just so reassuring, I think, probably for many, that it's not, yeah, you had to go through that big journey to get to that point. It's not you suddenly switch it on and you understand and feel everything what your body's saying and you can be in tune all the time, 24/7. It's that moving and shifting through each day. Sarah, I just wanted to invite you in if there was anything you wanted to respond from what Joss has just said.
Yes, it's exciting and lovely to hear the word 18 years, Joss. That's just beautiful. Because even though I'm hearing that there are still imprints there are still clouds in the sky for each one of us, it's like it's our choice. It feels like you've got a lot more choice around, you know, ooh, there's something might be triggering me, or there's something coming up. It's not that it will go away, but it's kind of, you've got choices. I kind of wanted to sort of tune in with this whole theme, because for me, there's such an immediacy with aware parenting, as it's all there in the moment with the opportunity to heal and to be with all those big feelings. And yet it's the culture, isn't it, that we live in, that's so head-based. You know, if I have a client coming with a baby, they want to immediately know, why is my child crying, or how can I fix it, or what is it doing, and why is the five-year-old acting in this way with this behavior? And yet, even though, you know, we all might have our own opinions, or, you know, even philosophies around why a child is expressing feelings in that particular way, it's not really a necessary part of aware parenting, is it? Like, I'm reflecting from, say, pre and perinatal work, you know, we might put meaning on certain tears or certain gestures a child makes, but actually we don't, there's not a requirement to do that, is there? It's just the immediacy of just being there, which is that.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's also one of the beautiful things about aware parenting, is it really supports us to cultivate deep trust in our children and their own knowing and their own wisdom about what they need and their own process around how to then heal. But yeah, it's actually a real relief for parents, I think, to know that you don't have to understand always. You don't have to know. You don't need to be clear about why or where. All you need to do is be reminding yourself that behavior is always communicating a legitimate need or a legitimate feeling, whether that's a need for information or some other unmet need or some accumulated feelings there. And you don't need to know what's underneath that. You just need to then be able to go in and identify how best to support them. It's a really simple, I mean, it's not easy, but it's a very simple and beautiful way of looking at behavior that, like you say, is so far away from how the vast majority of our culture views behavior in children.
Yeah, I mean, do you have, just perhaps before we move on to something more experiential, I'd just love to hear, in a way, a good news story. You could make it up a little bit with a fusion of perhaps some of your clients, but, you know, somebody coming along perhaps with a certain behaviour and then seeing the cycle of things, you know, in a way, getting the muscles perhaps to listen to some of those feelings and be with, you know, the huge emotional storms and how that kind of panned out. You know, would it be possible to give us a kind of some real life stories, clients or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's really helpful for people is when they come wanting support because their child's being really aggressive. This is something I think that is one of the most challenging things to be parenting. And it's quite common. It seems that if you're welcoming feelings, you're going to get lots of feelings, and often they're going to come out in ways that are quite difficult to manage whilst you're finding your way with it. And so often parents come saying, you know, my child is hitting or, you know, shouting or scratching or, you know, hitting their sister or whatever it is. And that's something that we experience in our family too, of course. So it's a really normal thing when children are allowed to be themselves. Sometimes the way they are, particularly as they are starting this healing journey, can be quite uncomfortable to watch. And I think what's really beautiful is watching and supporting parents to understand what's going on when a child is behaving in that way. Understanding what's happening at a neurobiological level and what's happening in their bodies. And to start to change the dialogue that they might be having around there being something wrong with their child, or that they've done something wrong in parenting, that they've made all these mistakes, or that their child is somehow going to grow up to be a violent person, or, you know, any of those stories that might be coming up, but also to be exploring what are the parts for them in that story. So what are the parts in them that are being activated when they see their child behaving in this way? It might be that, you know, they were on the receiving end of harshness and aggression themselves. It might be that they perpetrated harshness and aggression, or both. But identifying that part of the story and supporting the younger parts in that experience then allows parents to come to this place where they have tools to be able to really support their children to, for example, using loving limits and, you know, offering this warmth connection, and also to really support themselves. And the more that they're supporting themselves, the more they can show up in this really embodied and grounded way to support their children through that, and to bring in play and to offer experiences of power through paraversal games or through, you know, special time and having those moments of deep connection to bring more emotional safety for the children. There's so many beautiful things that they can bring in, but it's like this whole picture, isn't it? And at the end of those processes, which often takes time for parents to really go through this, it's not like a simple quick fix sort of, you know, you listen to feelings, you explore yourself a little bit, and then your child stops hitting. It's a big process, but at the end of that process, the love and the connection and the joy and the complete I don't even know what the words are, but just the absolute delight that these parents have in their experiences with their children, supporting them in a way that really brings them back to balance is just so beautiful. And it is sometimes a long and it can be a very painful process for parents. And most parents are not getting the support that they need, even if they are having support from an aware parenting instructor. Most are highly stressed, living in a culture that doesn't understand this, where their needs are not getting met, and they're trying to implement something where they're probably not getting nearly enough listening for themselves and listening and support to address those younger parts of them. So it's a complex and difficult process for parents often, but the other side of it is just the most beautiful, loving, connected relationships and children who are not judged, who are not told that there's something wrong with them, and who know that they can show up and be unconditionally loved no matter how they're behaving, and to receive limits on their behavior when that's what they really need.
I'm really feeling that in my belly and my face, actually. I'm feeling sort of all round and fuzzy about, even the aspiration that parenting can be joyful. And, before I hand back to you, Vicky, I just wanted to say that I think it's a real sign, isn't it, for each parent to reflect, if I'm actually not enjoying parenting, if it's feeling a bit like a drag, I'm getting it in my shoulders, in my jaw, or wherever people hold their stress, you know, there is another way. And that in itself is perhaps the first place to start, isn't it? Like I could, you know, rewind back 25 years ago and say, well, gosh, I wish I'd known, you know. But it's like, if we can get to that point of just noticing that every day is a burden or a pain or whatever, it's a great sign that, you know, there is another way and there is tremendous support out there. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's lovely. Yeah, thank you for that question. I wondered, as we're talking about that, whether there's any capacity that you have built through your aware parenting journey to enable you to be able to hold. I know you mentioned there that you found that in your family there was big, you know, hitting or anger that came up. What have you done for yourself when you're meeting your needs to build capacity to be able to live the life that you're living now with your children?
Well, as I said, it's been a gradual process with bumpy ups and downs, and it's not smooth sailing. But I think one of the things that's really helpful is to come back again and again to that list of three things that's always underneath behavior, and to apply that to ourselves too. So looking at, you know, the thoughts piece, the needs piece, and the feelings piece for ourselves. So, you know, starting with feelings, I think, you know, listening time and receiving compassion and support externally is absolutely crucial. So for me, listening partners has been a big part of my journey. And now more than ever, even though I'm so far in, I get way more support now than I did in the early days. So like you were saying, Sarah, if I could go back, I had a listening partner right from the beginning. But if I could go back now, I would have 3 or 4 or 5 or 10. But yeah, when I get listening for myself, things shift for my children. They can sense that there's space and capacity in me to be able to bring me their feelings. And for me, part of listening has to be crying too, for me. Just getting listening and talking, I think that's part of getting into my body as well and getting out of my head. Lots of talking and reflecting and sharing is really helpful, but to get that real healing for me, I really need to do a lot of crying, and I've now learned how to do that, relearned how to do that, having switched that off many, many years ago. So that's really central. And I guess, yeah, when it comes to my nervous system support, it's also around taking care of myself and spending time looking at, what am I needing now and how can I bring that to my life. Is this an unmet need in the present, or is this a past unmet need that is a theme for me around not getting met, and how can I then address that to support myself? And for me also, it is around learning and exploring and reading and understanding more deeply all the time. That's really helpful for me, and understanding what's going on in my body, understanding the nervous system and these neurobiological responses that Elisa described so beautifully. And I think also just applying that same framework around, like, not having punishments, not punishing myself. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I had a lot of real harshness to myself for many years, and I just don't do that at all anymore. And for many years I haven't done that, and I notice that if I'm going into harshness or criticism or shaming, I just stop myself straight away, and I offer myself compassion and love. And learning to speak that language of compassion is hard too, because that's not a language we're surrounded by, and it's not a language that we're fluent in from our childhood either. So that's been a big part of the process, and that really supports me to build capacity just to be really mindful of the compassion that I need, and how important that is for me to be receiving that for myself.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And that is such a part, right? Having that, being able to listen and notice what your thoughts are saying to yourself, and being aware of how you're speaking to yourself. Because like you say, it's not something that's, you don't get taught that in school, right? It's not something that you learn about, of how you, what's going on in your mind. And I really enjoyed when you were saying actually about your needs. Is it a need in the moment, or is this a reoccurring need that is from the past that needs some healing, or can you change, have a choice? And so I talked about earlier about having choice. Can you choose a different way that you can meet that need or respond in that moment? So yeah, that was really lovely to be reminded of those moments. I've just got one last question, but before I go on to that, I wondered, is there anything, Joss, that you would like to, well, maybe I'll come to you actually after my last question, but Sarah first, is there anything else you would like to ask Joss in this moment before we go to the last question?
Well, it might be a bit of a big question, and it's just the one around crying as an adult. It's, you know, I find sometimes I can get into crying by doing that laughter yoga. By laughing, it can make me move into tears. But yeah, I notice that that's quite hard for me. I can be with feelings. I can be with the beginning of feelings. But to actually get into full-blown crying. I just wondered if there's anything particular you could say about ways that have supported you with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a hard one, isn't it? When, if it's something that we have learnt to suppress and hold in, and our culture encourages us still to do that. So it's quite a revolutionary thing to learn to cry. I think initially, it was receiving the kind of compassionate care that I'd always yearned for externally from people who really got this, that supported me to feel safe enough to move into tears and to cry, and to know that I didn't have to go, sorry, I'm crying, but somebody was actually saying, yes, I love your beautiful tears, bring them on. And I could finally really let go in it. And then to do it for myself, I mean, I still find it really helpful if I've got big feelings and big things going on, for my listening partners to be aware of that, because often them sending me beautiful messages nudges me gently into tears. And I think, yeah, initially I guess I found it really helpful, like, to watch really sad movies, because that was that's a fair enough place to cry, right? If it's a really sad movie, that's all right. Sure. To cry. And listening to beautiful music as well, like really touching music, can support me into tears as well. It's funny, my mum and dad never cried, ever, and we weren't allowed to cry as children, but the only time I ever saw my parents crying was when they were listening to particular pieces of classical music. And I remember as a child, sometimes, like on the nights before we went back to boarding school, my brother and I would always ask to listen to a particular piece of music, because we would cry and it would be okay for us to cry. Nobody would tell us to stop crying, because it's allowed to cry to that. So initially for me, it was listening to that piece of music would really bring the tears on. And, you know, now I know that I feel safe. I know that I'm not going to drown. I think having the experience of really being in big feelings and not drowning is, yes, really reassuring, to know that actually you can go back there and do it again. And the feeling that I get in my body after big tears is just beautiful. I mean, it's unlike anything else. That sense of relaxation and calm and connection and balance and joy and lightness. And so, you know, that's quite motivating to keep doing it. But it's, you know, there are times when it feels safer than others. And I think having people who can really understand this approach and really get the benefit of it for our children and for us, there with you, holding your hand, makes a huge difference, particularly to start with. So, yeah, having sessions with people who get it and who will help you is just so important.
I'd love to ask you after the podcast if we could have a couple of those magical songs. It feels like we could make a little playlist, sort of emoting playlists for those that want to release and let go. It would be magical. So,
yeah.
My final wish from you, Joseph, would be amazing. Thank you so much for coming. I know Vicky has a magical question to ask.
Actually, I now have one more following that question before I ask the magical one. Just on that, what have you said, or what did you do for yourself with holding your tears around your children? Would you allow your tears to come with your children being there? How would you embrace and hold into what you were feeling whilst being surrounded by your, because often we're, you know, I know you home educate your children as well, so you and I'm on that journey myself now, you can't always separate yourself, and this is my little stickler bit where I'm at now, is how do I have those moments when they're not ever, they're always there. So yeah
I think it's a beautiful thing to do, to cry in front of your children. I think it's a really amazing experience. I think what really is crucial in there is, first of all, to explain, particularly when they're little, that you've just got big feelings. Mummy's got big feelings and it's not your fault, and I'm just going to take care of myself, or I'm going to reach out for support. And my children very quickly learnt that it wasn't anything to be scared of if I had big feelings, because I've made it clear that they weren't responsible, and I also never expected them to listen to me. And so over the years, my kids just totally understood that, you know, there would be lots of times it was very normal. Mummy would have big feelings, and when she had big feelings, she would cry. And when she was crying, she would, you know, look after herself, and she would reach out for support, and she would, you know, explain and take care of them so that they could just go off and do whatever they were going to do. And as my children got older, they just became really comfortable with feelings. And, you know, my kids, if I cry now, my children will just be with me in that, and they won't, you know, they don't feel responsible for my feelings. They don't feel like they've caused my feelings, but they also don't feel like they have to be there to support me in that. But it's just not a big scary thing for them. It's just part of life. So I think modeling that to your child is really beautiful. After all, we're often like nudging them into feelings that they probably don't really want to go into. They might be quite distracting themselves, thank you very much, and not really want to go into those feelings. So we really have to be showing them that actually we get it. We get that it feels scary and it feels unsafe sometimes, and we're experiencing that too, and yet we're also willing to go there because that's where the healing lies. And so I think it's a really profound thing to do in front of your children.
Lovely. Yeah, that's really, it really resonates well. Thank you. So, yeah, the final question is, can you offer our listeners one of your favourite ways of bringing yourself back into connection with yourself and others? Obviously, you can have more than one if you feel the need to.
So I think what I find most helpful is to take time deliberately to tune into what's going on in my body and what's coming up for me. And so, you know, that usually starts with some basic relaxation, some connecting in with the breath, bringing in some sort of mindful relaxation process for myself. And then I just tune in and I ask myself, I do like a body scan really, and I ask myself, you know, what's happening inside my body? What does it feel like in my body right now? What sensations am I aware of? What's coming up? And sometimes if nothing jumps out at me, then I will just go through this scan like, okay, let's just take a moment to tune into my head and what's happening in my neck and my jaw or my shoulders, my throat, you know, and go down the body that way. But usually sensations are obvious fairly quickly and my attention is taken towards that. And then I just sort of stay with it and notice what's there, what it feels like, how I might describe it, or, you know, what the experience is of experiencing it. And, you know, just noticing and just staying with the sensations and noticing what happens and what happens next and what happens next and what happens next. And then coming back to the breath if I'm getting distracted. And then like usually it starts to morph a bit, whatever it is inside me, and it moves around or it lessens or it expands or whatever. And then I just sort of stay with it and I start to ask, you know, what's here for me? What does this sensation want to tell me? What does this sensation want to show me or teach me or tell me? And, you know, what's familiar about this experience at the moment? And I just try to be curious and to remind myself that I'm safe as I just sort of explore it and allow it to show me what it is that it wants to tell me. And, sometimes I then speak what it is that I'm feeling and what's coming up. And sometimes I'm just there with it. And then, yeah, noticing what the shift is in my body then. And sometimes I go into tears in those moments. And, you know, have a really big cry, and then I just stay in the crying. And at the end of that process, then I kind of guide myself back to feeling, you know, where I am in the room and what's going on around me and what I can feel and what I'm aware of in my body. And then, yeah, usually I have my hands on my heart. That really supports me. So I'm usually like in some kind of position like that. I'm always lying down because I have some injuries in my back. So if I sit up, I get this sensation in my back that distracts my attention away from what else is going on in my body. So yeah, I mean, offering myself compassion and love to whatever it is that's going on. And if the sensations feel too big and I want to just distract myself and I go off on a distraction thing, I try not to judge myself in that moment. And I try to, again, be really kind and compassionate and just allow myself to keep doing that and to be, yeah, allowing that to happen. Like it, so it doesn't have to look a particular way. There's no pressure or coercion. And yeah, that's one of the ones that I really love. The other ones I really love are just being in nature and just being aware of my surroundings and, you know, tuning in with the different senses and the experience of each of those senses in that moment. But that's usually less about what I'm feeling and what's inside and more just about restoring and building capacity.
Yeah, lovely. And I really noticed as you're exploring and talking about that, your hands would naturally come into the contact with your body and would give that extra feedback. And like you're saying, holding the chest. Have you found that that is something that you draw? A lot of my work actually uses touch with your own body. Have you noticed that something that you bring in often when you're doing your body scans and connecting in?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, you know, when we think of Elisa's beautiful balance of attention, what we're trying to do is connect to the feelings and get a sense of emotional safety. And for me, the touch is what brings that emotional safety for me to offer myself the balance of attention. So yeah, often it's hands on my heart. Sometimes it's hands on my throat. Sometimes it's holding myself, like hugging myself around my shoulders. Sometimes it might be rubbing my legs. Sometimes, yeah, I mean, there's often this sense that of holding myself with tenderness and love in some physical way as well as metaphysically at the same time. I find that really helpful.
Mm, lovely. So beautiful. Sarah, did you want to have any final reflection on what Joss has said?
Oh, just like a lovely reflection, Joss. It's just what I'm getting from what you're saying is that there's the heart. Our hearts that are in a way can experience all kinds of weather conditions, emotions of all kinds. And yet there's the stability in your heart, the core of you that you're kind of protecting with your hands and with your attention and your breath, which is just so beautiful and such a lovely reminder for everybody that these things are just passing through. Even though we think we're going to drown, there's the core of us that is shining bright all the time, which is such a lovely reminder. Thank you.
Yeah, beautiful. And at times when we don't feel that, we know that we can reach out for that sense externally from somebody else to support us back to that. Because sometimes it feels too big. And I definitely have those moments as well. So getting that externally supports that too when we can't offer that to ourselves.
Wonderful.
That's so wonderful. I just want to say a really big thank you, Joss, for taking the time out to join us. It's been really delightful and added another beautiful layer to our podcast on understanding really what it is to embody aware parenting and take that a bit further in the parenting journey. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you both so much for having me, and thank you for all the beautiful work that you're doing, sharing this deepening in people's understanding of aware parenting and how to practice it and how to offer it to themselves and their children. So thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. Aware parenting has been life-changing for both of our families, and we'd love to hear your reflections and answer your questions.
Contact Vicky and Sarah on the links below. We both offer a free introductory consultation. We'd love to hear from you. Let's discover the joy of parenting together.